to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, December 12th. I'm Dagna, your reader for today. We'll begin with today's 5-day forecast, and today is going to be a little bit colder with increasing clouds, with a high today of 36 and a low tonight of 20. Wednesday will be milder and mostly sunny with a high of 46 and a low of 25. Thursday will be mild with periods of sun with a high of 46 and a low of 34. Friday will be breezy in the afternoon with a high of 48 and a low of 26. And then Saturday will be sunshine with patchy clouds with a high of 42 and a low of 26. Today's mini editorial is written by the Journal Editorial Board, and they write, requests for Goodfellow toys were up significantly this year. To give to the organization or to learn more, visit the donor page online at goodfellowscharity.org. Again, this was from the Journal Editorial Board. Our first article today from the front page is from the City Council. Council OKs Development Agreement. The Sioux City Council, by voting in favor of its consent agenda Monday, approved a development and minimum assessment agreement with a distributor of construction and mining equipment. Road Machinery and Supplies Company is relocating its Sioux City operations to Expedition Business Park by Sioux Gateway Airport. This past summer, the company expressed interest in purchasing land in the Expedition Business Park at the intersection of Al Haynes Drive and Discovery Boulevard for a new location for their Sioux City operation. The Minnesota-based company currently has a location at 1400 Lewis Boulevard. There was no discussion before the council approved the agreement. As part of the project, the company proposes to purchase the 11.47-acre parcel from the city and construct a 10,080-square-foot facility. The facility will include offices, high bay space for servicing equipment, a wash bay, and space for outdoor storage of equipment and machinery. The proposed purchase price is $37,897 per acre for a total price of $434,679. Six existing jobs will be retained, and the company will likely add new employees as it expands its presence in the region, according to city documents. Under the terms of the Development and Minimum Assessment Agreement, Road Machinery and Supplies Company will purchase Lot 5 for $434,679, construct a new heavy equipment sales and service center on the parcel, retain the existing six employees, and commit to a minimum assessed value of $2 million on the completed project for a period of 10 years. The company will also provide the city with a right of first refusal on the remnant property, which remains after the development of the original facility, according to the documents. The city, in turn, will sell Lot 5 in Expedition Business Park to Road Machinery and Supplies Company and provide a series of property tax rebates on a graduated scale as detailed in the development agreement. The documents state that the city will see immediate revenue through the proceeds of the land sale and will also see an increased tax revenue through new development on the site. And in other council news, the council, by approving its consent agenda, also greenlighted a resolution adopting plans, specifications, form of contract, and estimated cost for the construction of the fiscal year 24 Grandview Park Hot Mix Asphalt, or HMA, overlay project. The HMA overlay of the park road will preserve the road's integrity and mitigate damage to the park from the demolition of two water tanks in the park. The project includes the construction of public right-of-way accessibility guidelines, compliant sidewalk ramps along the park road, a 1.5-inch HMA overlay of the park road, including the playground playing area, and the restriping of the playground parking lot. All construction work is scheduled to be completed before Saturday in the park on July 6th, according to city documents. The documents state that city staff is ready to go out for bid on the project on Friday, with a bid deadline of January 9th. The project would have a late start date of May 20th and be completed within 20 working days. The engineer's opinion of probable construction costs for the base bid is $200,000. The engineer's opinion of probable cost with the bid alternate to allow the contractor to keep the asphalt millings is $195,000. Our next article is about school district job restructuring, trimming expenses. The Sioux City Community School District will eliminate 65 staff positions due to the loss of COVID-19 recovery fund, but will not fire any teachers in the process. The Sioux City School Board approved a restructuring plan for next year to account for the loss of elementary and secondary school emergency relief funding, or ESSER funds. The district received $59.4 million in funding for COVID-19 recovery. The fund has provided $7.6 million per year of additional staffing for the district. The district decided to remove 65 positions to make up for the loss of the funding. In doing so, the district then restructured 33 positions to continue certain services that they felt were necessary. Sioux City Associate Superintendent Angela Bima said staffing makes up more than 80% of the district's $240 million budget. We have very few expenditures over a couple $100,000 a year that are recurring that we could cut, she said. So we knew that staffing had to be part of the cut. Bima stressed that the cuts do not mean the district felt the jobs were not important, but the district had to make hard decisions because of money. It's the right decision, but it's not easy and it's not fun, and we don't expect people to be happy about them, she said. It's never happy to have to cut. The funds are called the Elementary Secondary School Emergency Relief Funds, or ESSER. The goal of the funding was for states and schools to support students who had been most impacted by the pandemic and address longstanding inequities that may have been exacerbated. The distribution to the Sioux City schools included $2.8 million for ESSER 1, $17.3 million for ESSER 2, and $38.9 million for ESSER 3. Bima said the 4 years of funds allowed the district to do amazing things, such as building the district's trade building, enhancing the career academy with the addition of a virtual school, replacing the filtration systems in school buildings, buying buses, and more. The district was also able to add staff to reduce class sizes and provide more support, both emotionally and educationally, Bima said. The ESSER funds must be spent by June 30th. Because the fund was a one-time allotment, the district had to find a way to either absorb the $7.6 million in recurring expenses being paid for with ESSER funds or remove the expenses. Beginning in January of last year, Bemis and the administration started looking into how to reduce the reoccurring expenses. She said they had to assess how to eliminate the expenses while ensuring the students still get the support they need. She said, rather than just cut every position we added, we realized that there were a lot of positions that we added that really encompassed a lot of positions we had, or they transformed into different positions that were even better. She said they began looking at what positions they have, what the students need, and how can the district combine or recreate positions. So we may have less people, but we are still giving the support, she said. To ensure the process was done fairly, the administration created a set of guiding principles to assess the position. Bima said the guiding principles were putting staff in front of students, having equity in resources across the district, making decisions based on structures and systems, and keeping the middle school teaming structure. The positions eliminated included CNAs, building consulting teachers, technology consulting teachers, virtual counselor, district administrator behavior specialist, permanent substitutes, family support coordinator, recruitment specialist, support specialist certification changes, alternative support teachers. Bima said some of the staff members knew their positions were short-term, such as the CNAs, retention specialists, and permanent substitutes, so when individuals left the positions, the district did not fill them. For the permanent substitutes, Bima said there are enough substitutes needed in the district that someone could substitute every day of the school year if they wanted. You can be a permanent sub because you can sub every day in Sioux City if you want, she said. Through the process of eliminating positions, Bima said there were some positions that the district wanted to keep and other positions that could be combined into one. The positions restructured included 5 elementary school Tier 1 coordinators, 3 middle school Tier 1 coordinators, 3 high school Tier 1 coordinators, 3 alternative education teachers, a career and technical education curriculum facilitator, a foreign language head teacher, 2 elementary school MTSS specialists, 6 high school MTSS specialists, an English language learners and dual language curriculum facilitator, 1 elementary tier 3 behavior support specialist, 1 secondary school's tier 3 behavior support specialist, and 3 high school alternative education support specialists. Bibas pointed to teacher leaders as an example of how the district reformatted the jobs. Instead of having 2 or 3 teacher leaders in each school, they decided to have teacher leaders assigned to a building level and then divided by the 3 sides of town. Each of those people will now have to serve 2 or 3 schools rather than 1 school, she said. They then created a few new positions that took on more managerial work. These positions don't require the person to have a teaching degree, therefore they have a lower salary, and it gives more opportunities to people in the community, Bemis said. Bemis said no teachers were fired in the process of restructuring. She said because of the ongoing teacher shortage, there were several positions available for those affected to apply for. The impacted teachers get first rights to those jobs. We will not hire anybody outside of the district until all those people are placed into a position that they want, she said. Other reductions made are including closing 2 pools, ending whole chunk lease for a career academy classroom, ending iJag, ending hotspot offerings for students, removing district cell phones and creating a stipend program, ending MOU partnerships with community programs that were started with the ESSER funds, and no longer providing busing for parochial school busing. Those reductions saved the district $750,000, the equivalent of 10 teachers, Bemis said. When asked about the closure of North High and East High pools, Bemis said each pool had $50,000 in annual expenses, as well as $1 million in needed repairs overall. She said pools and swimming are not in the district's curriculum, and the district's metro swimming team only practices at West High. The only people who use the other 2 pools are community groups, and if they can raise the money for operation and repairs, Bemis said they would be happy to work together. Bemis said people may question why the district needed to make $7.6 million in cuts when they have $70 million in spending authority saved. With the release of the Educational Savings Act and the concerns regarding state supplemental aid, Bemis said the district needs to have those savings to prevent any future staffing reductions. The Educational Savings Act gives families public dollars to send their children to private schools. Students who participate in the program receive $7,598 every year to be put toward tuition, textbooks, classroom materials, and other types of educational programming expenses. Public schools lose out on the per-pupil funding for any student who chooses to utilize the program, but the districts do receive $1,200 in state funding for each student who leaves the public school system. Bemis said the program is $40 million over budget this year, and it is estimated to be upwards of 400% over budget in 3 years. That money is going to come away from us, which will then impact our student supplemental aid, she said. The state supplemental aid, or SSA, provides a set per pupil amount for funding from the state to school districts. This year, the districts received a 3% increase in SSA, giving schools $7,635 per pupil. Bemis said the district regularly needs a 5% increase to maintain services. We have not gotten 5% in the last 15 years. It's just going to keep going down because that money is going to private schools, she said. So that $70 million is to ensure that over the next 5 to 8 years, we don't have to worry about eliminating any positions. And our next story, a headline is Fort Calhoun Priest's Death Shocks Community's Residents. Fort Calhoun residents were still in shock one day after the local Roman Catholic priest was stabbed to death. Shortly after 5 a.m. Sunday, Washington County Sheriff's deputies found Reverend Stephen Gutskill, a 65-year-old priest at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church, stabbed in the church rectory. Gutskill was taken by ambulance to the Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha, where he died, Sheriff Mike Robinson said. And this is Fort Calhoun, Nebraska. Robinson said Gutskill placed a call to 911 about 5 a.m. and said someone was attempting to break into the rectory. Deputies arrived within minutes and found Gutskill suffering from stab wounds, he said. Kiri L. Williams, a 43-year-old from Sioux City, Iowa, was taken into custody at the scene. He was later arrested on suspicion of homicide and the use of a weapon to commit a felony. Gutskill's death came as a shock to residents of Fort Calhoun, a small town of approximately 1,000 people located about 17 miles north of Omaha. Gutskill had been serving as priest of St. John's Parish for about a decade. Andy Foucher, who co-owns the Longhorn Bar and Grill, first became aware of the incident when he saw multiple law enforcement vehicles outside the rectory located one block east of Highway 75 around 7 a.m. Sunday. It is a shock when you see more than one police car with a siren and lights on, he said. Erica Donahoe, owner and stylist at the Sheer Attraction Salon, said she woke up to see the crime scene tape outside her bedroom window. Donahoe, who is a St. John's parishioner, described Gutskill as a very genuine man who would do anything for anybody. Donahoe said, "Anytime you needed somebody to talk to or, you know, get that positive input that God is with you, he was there for you." Foucher, who met Gutskill at several community events, described the priest as a nice, quiet, humble man. "You just don't expect something like that in this type of community," Foucher said. "It's a very small town. Everybody knows everybody." Gutskill came to the Fort Calhoun Parish sometime after he pleaded guilty in 2007 to felony theft by deception for embezzling $127,000 from St. Patrick Catholic Church in Omaha. Gutskill was sentenced to 5 years of probation in order to pay restitution. Donahoe and Foucher said they had no idea who Williams was before he was arrested. "I've never seen him in the community before, so I don't know who he is," Foucher said. "We've never had him here at the Longhorn before that I can ever remember. He wasn't somebody people had seen before in Fort Calhoun," Donahoe said. Although the regularly scheduled 8:30 a.m. Mass at St. John's was canceled Sunday, the Catholic community came together in the wake of Gutskill's death. Archbishop George Lucas led a special Mass at St. Francis Borgia Catholic Church in Blair. According to St. John's deacon Jerry Mapes, Fort Calhoun residents who attended the Mass said the Archbishop's words were comforting and helpful. "Lucas stayed after Mass to console the members of St. John the Baptist," Mapes said. Mapes said Lucas offered to come to Fort Calhoun whenever he was needed to say Mass or do whatever he could. Lucas also told parishioners that priests from all over the archdiocese had been calling him, offering their services to the members of the Fort Calhoun Church. The Reverend Damian Weiss of St. Francis Borgia conducted a prayer service at St. John the Baptist on Sunday night. Mapes said the church was full and many people in attendance were not parishioners. "Last night at the prayer service, I saw a lot of people there who I know are not Catholic," Mapes said. "This senseless act of random violence occurred without any rhyme or reason and has really shaken our community." Gutskill's homicide is the second one in Fort Calhoun this year. Linda Childers, 71, was found dead in her rural home on August 14th. Authorities believe she was killed the previous day during a home invasion. In that case, William P. Collins has been charged with first-degree murder, 2 counts of using a weapon to commit a felony, possession of a firearm by a prohibited person, possession of a deadly weapon by a prohibited person, first-degree assault, burglary, possession of a stolen firearm, and theft. Authorities said there does not appear there is a connection between Collins and Childers. The violence in Fort Calhoun this year is disturbing to the town's residents. "You just don't expect that in a small town," Foucher said. "Usually the talk of the town is something like, oh, we got a new stop sign, or so-and-so got picked up for speeding. That's kind of the max of what you want to have happen in a small town. To get rocked twice by these types of events is horrible." Alleged rape of Woodbury County nursing home resident under investigation. The Woodbury County Sheriff's Office says it is investigating the alleged rape of an Iowa nursing home resident who was subsequently evicted and dumped at a homeless shelter. It is not clear whether the criminal investigation is focused entirely on the reported rape or includes the manner in which the resident was treated by the care facility in the days that followed the alleged incident. It is an ongoing investigation, and at this point an arrest has not been made, Woodbury County Sheriff Chad Sheehan said Monday. That doesn't mean there will not be an arrest. It's just that the investigation is still ongoing. There's no new information to share at this time. State nursing home inspectors say a female resident at Correctionville Specialty Care complained in October that a male certified nurse aide had forced her to perform a sex act on him and had sent her a video of him pleasuring himself. The woman allegedly provided sheriff's office personnel with a copy of that video. According to state inspectors, the care facility retaliated against the woman by evicting her from the home on short notice and then dumping her at a homeless shelter with no advance notice to the shelter and without her medical records. The company that owns and manages the home, Care Initiatives of West Des Moines, has said that it investigated the allegations of inappropriate behavior between a team member and a prior resident and that the involved parties are no longer employed by Care Initiatives. According to state inspectors, the alleged rape victim is not cognitively impaired, but was being treated for numerous physical issues such as lung cancer, heart failure, high blood pressure, diabetes, and anxiety. State records indicate that on November 1st, deputies from the Woodbury County Sheriff's Office interviewed the woman about the allegations of sexual abuse. The woman allegedly told deputies that on one particular evening in the first or second week of October, she had gone outside to smoke a cigarette and a male aide offered to let her smoke in his car. He then pushed her wheelchair to his vehicle, which was parked close to a stand of trees along the parking lot. Once inside the vehicle, the aide allegedly forced her to perform oral sex on him while seemingly making a video recording of the encounter on his phone. Afterward, the woman told authorities she went directly to her room, spoke to no one, and the two never discussed the incident. A dietary aide later told inspectors the woman informed her and a colleague of the incident, which they then reported to the home's administrator. The administrator allegedly suspended the accused aide, who denied any sexual activity had taken place, and then confronted the alleged victim, accusing her of providing sexual favors to the staff in return for cigarettes, an allegation the resident denied. Within hours, the administrator allegedly informed the resident she had to leave. A nurse aide who worked at the home told inspectors the administrator yelled at the resident and gave her 30 minutes to pack up her belongings in preparation for her eviction. The next day, on October 25th, the woman was dropped off at a homeless shelter. The shelter employee told inspectors that within hours of the woman being dropped off, they had to call 911 due to her shaking, falling, and appearing unstable. The next day, the resident returned to the shelter from the hospital, and a friend came and picked her up. Corporate timesheets allegedly confirmed the accused aide continued to work with a vulnerable elderly population in Care Initiative facilities on October 24th, October 28th, and October 30th, according to state inspectors. The Iowa Department of Inspections, Appeals, and Licensing has cited the home for failing to adequately investigate or report to the state the allegation of rape. The department has also cited the home for dropping off the alleged rape victim at a homeless shelter, calling it retribution for the report of rape. We'll now move to a regular Tuesday feature. It's called Five Questions With, and today's is with the Food Bank of Siouxland Director Jacob Watershide. And the article, the Sioux City Journal reporter is Peggy Senzarino. Food is a large part of the celebration of the Christmas holidays for many throughout Siouxland. Jacob Watershide, executive director of the Food Bank of Siouxland, works to see that food insecure residents in an 11-county area get food at the holidays and throughout the entire year. Watershide joined the Food Bank in August 2013 and was named executive director in 2020. The Journal spoke with Watershide last week about the work of the Food Bank and how the public can help this holiday season. First question, what types of donations are needed the most at the Food Bank? An answer. When I first started, our biggest received and distributed product was canned vegetables, and that was somewhere near 300,000 pounds. And the trend within Siouxland is we are fairly saturated and we have a great opportunity with our packing plants. In 2017, we expanded our freezer and cooler to hold a lot more product and really started seeing a shift, but we really saw a shift from canned items to fresh and frozen protein and refrigerated dairy and really saw that grow. Those are the things that people want to see the most. We really like to provide that protein, fresh produce, and dairy. We always encourage the general public to call and ask and really target a donation. Also, what would you most like to receive if you were hungry? Ask yourself when you make that donation, what is something you really find helpful, necessary, and would really want to have in your pantry at home? That's a great donation to give. Next question. How does the food bank work? Again, the food bank is a collection site. We are an organization that will go to donors of all types, financial corporations and manufacturers, retail locations, and pick up product that they would like to donate. We bring it back to the warehouse, sort through it, put it on a menu that a nonprofit organization can come in and pick up stuff that we have set aside for pickups, or we do have a menu that has a pre-selected items like cases of corn, mixed fruit, cases of ground beef that are on the menu that they can have delivered or pick up. Most of the food pantries that we work with are volunteer-led and kind of do it on the side, and we work really hard that there's a food pantry available every day in the Metro Sioux City area. And we try to have a good pattern that we are getting to as many communities as we can outside the metro area. Next question. How big of an area are you a conduit for donations? And we cover an 11-county area. We are probably an hour and a half in most directions from Sioux City. That's about as far as we go. And then what do you enjoy about your job here? I think the thing that I enjoy the most is knowing that we are helping somebody and we can immediately see that. When I first started, we had a lot more ability to get out and meet the people we work with. Again, we have over 106 agencies we work with. Without them, we really could not do the work. We work as hard as we can to be a 365-day supplier to our partners that hand out food to people in need. And then the last question, what are you thankful for this year? And the answer, I think I am thankful for the friends that we've made and the networks that we are able to work with. Our next story, alleged Iowa tree thief claims legal protection by an 800-year-old charter. An 800-year-old English charter that was hugely consequential for establishing rights of people to use public lands also protects a rural Rolfe, Iowa man accused of illegally cutting down and stealing dozens of trees from a wildlife management area in northwest Iowa, the man's attorney argues. That is among several reasons why Jason Levon Ferguson, 41, wants a judge to reverse a jury's verdict last month that he is guilty of 51 charges of taking the trees without permission from public property in Pocahontas County. His attorney, Kevin Forrest of Harcourt, argues that the provisions of the Charter of the Forest issued in 1217 by King Henry III were transferred by common law to the United States when it declared independence from England, according to documents Forrest filed in the state district court. Forrest pointed to a paragraph in the charter that says, "Every freeman may agest his own wood within our forest at his pleasure and shall take his pawnage." When we have the need to depend upon those rights, they need to be there for our protection and our society. We'll not endure and we will spiral into authoritarianism much the same as happened in the time before the Charter of the Forest, Forrest wrote. Ferguson allegedly took more than 100 trees from the Stoddard Wildlife Management Area over the course of more than a year and planned to use the lumber to build a house, according to court records. One of the trees was a very old bur oak tree that was 6 feet in diameter at its base. The Iowa Capital Dispatch published a news article several days before Ferguson's trial about timber thefts in the state that in part detailed the accusations against him. It was republished by several newspapers. The lawyer, Forrest, wrote, "This article was picked up by other sources and was so dominant that it became an issue of a political rally of presidential politicians in Pocahontas during the trial." He did not elaborate. The article included information about Ferguson's status as a felon and that a search of his property yielded evidence that someone was growing marijuana and manufacturing meth there. The article detailed how that evidence was suppressed before the search was improperly approved by a magistrate. Forrest said jurors would have likely seen the news coverage and that the state has colluded with the Capitol Dispatch to influence jurors. Forrest wrote, "It is well known that in Russia, the state uses the news to assert its positions. This has been especially noticeable since the start of the war in Ukraine. This is the first time I have been involved in a case where those tactics were used by the state so vehemently against my client." The Iowa Department of Natural Resources, which was the Capitol Dispatch primary source of information about timber thefts, provided that information at a reporter's request and had no influence over what the article contained or when it was published. Court records indicate potential jurors were asked whether they had seen news coverage of the allegations against Ferguson. The trial went for 4 days, and the judges often admonished jurors to avoid news media during breaks in trials. The Fort Dodge Messenger newspaper had published an article more than a year ago that detailed drug and weapons allegations against Ferguson. Forrest, who has been a licensed attorney in Iowa for nearly 40 years, also said he failed to object to a prosecution argument that Forrest claims violated Ferguson's right against self-incrimination. Forrest wrote, "The defendant's attorney has only been trying one jury trial year since the beginning of the pandemic and as such was rusty and did not object to the testimony of trial. This failure to object was a failure to provide the defendant with effective assistance of counsel." Forrest said it was improper for the prosecutor to criticize the defense for not producing a witness to testify that Ferguson had previously had permission to take trees from the property as he had claimed. Forrest argued that because Ferguson himself could have testified about the issue, the prosecutor's argument insinuated Ferguson is guilty because he did not testify, which would violate the Fifth Amendment. He said his failure to object would most likely be the subject of a post-conviction appeal if a judge accepts the jury's verdict. Ferguson seeks an acquittal or a new trial. He is set to be sentenced next month and faces up to 5 years in prison for a felony theft charge and 1 year each for the 50 timber buyer violation charges. Pocahontas County Attorney Daniel Feinster, who is prosecuting the case, has not yet filed written response to Forrest's motions. He told Iowa Capitol Dispatch he anticipates the issues will be discussed at a hearing prior to sentencing. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, December 12th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Kenneth Peter Peterson, aged 78, of Des Moines, passed away at Ramsey Village in Des Moines on Saturday, November 25th. Celebration of Life service will be at 4 p.m. Saturday, December 16th. The Hartley Funeral Home Chapel in Hartley, followed by food and fellowship at the Hartley American Legion, located in downtown Hartley. There are no formal visitation hours scheduled. The Hartley Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Warren Tubby Everett Mitchell, a beloved member of the Sioux City community, departed this world on December 9th, leaving behind a legacy of love, dedication, and a life well lived. Born in Sioux City on March 7, 1947, Tubby's journey was marked by enduring love, meaningful relationships, and a profound impact on those fortunate enough to know him. In 1964, Tubby married the love of his life, Peggy Wynn, embarking on a 59-year journey together. Tubby's professional journey began in auto repair under the guidance of his mentor, Henry Skogie Skoglund. This experience fueled his entrepreneurial spirit, leading Tubby and Peg to establish Prestige Paint and Body in 1974, a successful business they nurtured for an impressive 45 years. Tubby's love for cars extended beyond his profession, drawing him to the local street car club, the Odd Rods. His commitment to community service was exemplified through his active involvement in the Cosmopolitan Club, where he dedicated his time and resources to various charitable causes, including the Sioux City Boys Club. A man of faith, Tubby played a significant role in his church as an elder, and alongside Peg, led the youth group for many years. His impact on the spiritual growth of those around him was immeasurable. One of Tubby's dreams was to have land and a small farm. In 1975, he and Peg moved to the outskirts of Sioux City, and with the guidance of his dear friend Lester Williams, Tubby cultivated a passion for farming that became a cherished hobby. Later in life, Tubby and Peg discovered the joy of Harley-Davidson motorcycles, forming close bonds with a group of friends who embarked on countless adventures across the United States. These journeys led them to Tucson, Arizona, where they spent winters, creating lasting friendships and beautiful memories. Tubby's impact on the lives of those around him will be forever cherished, and his memory will live on in the hearts of all who had the privilege of knowing him. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made to St. Jude's in Tubby's honor, reflecting his commitment to making a positive impact on the community he held so dear. A celebration of Tubby's life will take place at 10:30 a.m. Friday, December 15th at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Sioux City, where friends and family will come together to share stories, memories, and pay tribute to a remarkable man whose legacy will endure through the ages. Family will greet friends on Thursday, December 14th, starting at 5 p.m. with a prayer service at 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel in Sioux City. Though Tubby may be gone from our sight, his spirit will forever remain in the hearts of those he touched. Norma Jean Dendinger, age 92, of Coleridge, Nebraska, died December 6th. The funeral will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, December 14th, at St. Michael's Catholic Church in Coleridge. Visitation will be Wednesday from 5 to 7 at the church. Arrangements are through Wince Funeral Home in Coleridge. Jim Hess, age 87, of Spirit Lake, passed away at Medina, Minnesota, on Saturday, December 9th. Funeral service will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, December 18th at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Spirit Lake. Visitation with the family will be from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, December 17th at the Hartley Funeral Home. Burial at Pleasant View Cemetery. The Hartley Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Earl James Moore, age 97, passed away on Sunday, December 10th in Sioux City. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, December 13th at Wesley Methodist Church on Indian Hills Drive with family present. A prayer service will be held at 7 p.m. Funeral services will be at the Wesley Methodist Church at 11 a.m. on Thursday, December 14th. Burial will be at the Graceland Park Cemetery. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel is assisting the family with arrangements. Earl was born February 3, 1926, on a farm east of Bronson, Iowa, to Dorothea and James DeWitt Moore. He attended elementary and junior high school at Winding Hill and Climbing Hill. Foster parents Les and Violet Kenny nurtured Earl's interest in sports and provided a loving home. He was a standout athlete at Bronson High School, where he played basketball and baseball. After graduation, he entered the U.S. Air Force, where he played baseball. Earl attended Iowa State University from 1946 to 1948, belonged to Sigma Nu fraternity, and played center field for the Cyclones. He graduated with a degree in business from Iowa State Teachers College, now University of Northern Iowa, in 1949. He earned a master's and doctorate of education degrees from the University of South Dakota. Earl was married on August 21, 1949, to Joyce Darlene Adams. They were married 74 years. After their marriage, Earl taught 1 year at Bronson High School and coached both girls and boys basketball. The boys' team won 22 games and came within one game of making it to the state tournament. He turned down a $100 raise and relocated to Beamer, Nebraska, where he taught business and coached boys basketball, baseball, and was an assistant football coach from 1950 to 1954. In 1954, Earl bought one-half interest in National Business Training School in Sioux City and taught and coached there from 1954 to 58. He made his final move in public education, moving to Central High School, where he taught business and was a counselor from 1958 to 1963. His final teaching position, his longest, was 1964 to 1990, was as a professor of psychology and department chair at Morningside College. He loved Morningside and was a devoted football and basketball fan. Earl belonged to American Legion Post 64, Masonic Lodge, Wesley United Methodist Church, Coachman Camping Camp, and was a member and past president of Interpol. For 14 years, he worked with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, traveling to Alaska, Maine, Florida, Arizona, and New Mexico, consulting Native Americans about alcoholism. He served as a Woodbury County court mediator and enjoyed his volunteer job as a docent at the Lewis and Clark Center in Sioux City. From 1990 to 2021, Earl and Joyce spent their winters in Bonita Springs, Florida. They enjoyed golf, softball, playing cards and games, and getting to meet wonderful new neighbors. While there, they belonged to Community Congregational Church and were weekly volunteers at the church thrift store. Earl was an avid camper, fisherman, and enjoyed bowling and golf. He especially enjoyed summer camping trips to Sibley State Park in Minnesota, where the extended Iowa and Minnesota families would meet for campfires, fishing, and long talks around the campfire. He and Joyce took great pride in their home, yard, beautiful flowers, and abundant garden. In later years, they especially enjoyed helping caterpillars become butterflies. They were also world travelers visiting 36 countries, including China, Egypt, Russia, the Holy Land, many European and Central American destinations. A special thank you to the staff at Northern Hills for providing loving care for Earl. Memorials may be made to the psychology department at Morningside College. Lois Christensen, age 98, of Hartley, Iowa, passed away at Daughtry Hospice House in Sioux Falls on Saturday, November 25th. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 16th, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Hartley. There are no formal visitation hours scheduled, but the family will be available at the lunch following the service. A private family burial took place at Pleasant View Cemetery near Hartley on Wednesday, November 29th. The Hartley Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Irene Elizabeth Putnam, 86, of Orillia, passed December 1st. Celebration of life will be 2:30 p.m. December 16th, and visitation will be from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. at the Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home in Ida Grove. Interment will be at Mount Hope Cemetery, Battle Creek. Arrangements by Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home of Ida Grove. James Daniel Nixon, a devoted husband and father, passed peacefully on Monday, December 4th, to join his beloved wife, Frances Lee Nixon. No services are being held at this time. A celebration of his life is planned for the spring of 2024, a fitting tribute to a life well lived. The family expresses deep appreciation for the compassionate care provided by Hospice of the Midwest, and memorials will be directed to them in honor of James Daniel Nixon. In the echoes of our cherished memories and the purr of well-loved engines, Jim's spirit will live forever endure. Arrangements are under the direction of Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Jim was born in Sioux City on August 3, 1932, to the late Glenn and Florence Nixon. His journey through life was marked by a profound love of family and an enduring passion for collecting cars and clocks, reflecting his appreciation for intricate and timeless. Jim was viewed as someone who could fix almost anything, a skill he put to good use as an engineer at IBM for over 30 years. Jim and Fran embarked on a remarkable journey of over 68 years of marriage. Introduced to each other at the Ames Avenue Methodist Church Youth Group in Omaha, they began their love story at Reed's Ice Cream Shop in the same city. The Methodist Church in Blair, Nebraska, witnessed their union on a snowy January 4, 1952. Jim's commitment extended beyond his family life, as he proudly served in the Navy on the island of Guam during the Korean War. His contributions included overseeing communications for the entire Pacific Theater and being part of the team that developed and implemented ground approach radar. Together, Jim and Fran raised three red-headed boys, Bradley James, Brian Anders, and Joel Allen. The Nixon family created homes in various places, from Oakland, California to Olathe, Kansas, Omaha, Sioux City, and for the past 27 years, Mobile, Iowa. Each location held a chapter in their beautiful story. Robert Jean Utesh, 95, of Haywarden, passed away on Thursday, December 7th, at his son's home in Lamar's under hospice care. Mass of Christian burial will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, December 13th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Haywarden, with Father Mauro Sanchez officiating. Burial will follow at Grace Hill Cemetery with military rites conducted by Two Oaks Post 254 of Haywarden and Albert E. Hochler Post 186 of Akron and the Iowa Army Honor Guard. Visitation with the family will begin at 5 p.m. Tuesday with a time of sharing at 6:45, followed by scriptures and prayers with Deacon Richard Port. The Porter Funeral Home in Haywarden is assisting the family. In lieu of flowers and gifts, the family prefers donation to the Midwest Honor Flight at MidwestHonorFlight.org in memory of Robert. Robert G. Newtesh was born in rural Plymouth County on August 19, 1928, the son of Elmer and Loretta Utesh. He attended rural schools and served in the United States Army for almost 2 years before transferring to the Army Reserves until April of 1957. He was proud to be a Korean War veteran. Robert married Kathleen Mary Const on April 27, 1953 at Ramona, South Dakota. They farmed and raised their family near Akron, Iowa, and retired to Haywarden in 2000. Robert was a proud member of the Knights of Columbus and a lifetime member of the American Legion. He enjoyed gardening, dancing, and fishing. Robert loved playing cards, vacations with good friends, and family visits. He loved the Lord, his family, and getting together with children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Robert's family will always remember his kind words of love yous. Lyle W. Johansson, age 90, of Wayne, Nebraska, and formerly of Wakefield, Nebraska, passed away Friday, December 8th, at the Providence Medical Center in Wayne. Services will be 11 a.m. on Saturday, December 16th, at Evangelical Covenant Church in Wakefield. The family will greet guests at 10 a.m. until service time at the church. Arrangements are with the Hassman Funeral Home of Wayne. Interment it will be in the Wakefield Cemetery in Wakefield. Memorials may be directed to Lyle's family for later designation. Daniel J. Callahan, 89, died on Thursday, December 7th at Mercy One Medical Center in Sioux City. A memorial service will be at 11 a.m. on Friday, December 15th at Christy Smith Morningside Chapel, located at 1801 Morningside Avenue, with John Buck of Sunnybrook Church officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. and the family will receive friends from 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, December 14th at Christy Smith Morningside Chapel, 1801 Morningside Avenue in Sioux City. Dan was born May 29, 1934 in Chicago to Daniel J. and Jewel Callahan. He grew up in Chicago and graduated from St. Philip's High School in Chicago. He went on to attend Moberly Junior College in Moberly, Missouri for 2 years, graduating in 1956, and then went to Drake University in Des Moines, where he graduated in 1958. Dan was united in marriage to Mary LaForce on August 6, 1960 in Moberly, Missouri. The first several years of marriage started in Missouri as Dan's coaching career began and he finished his master's degree. In 1964, the couple moved to Iowa, first to Mason City, coaching basketball, and then in 1966 they moved to Des Moines and he became the assistant basketball coach at Drake University. In 1971, he went to Valley High School in Des Moines to coach. They moved to Sioux City in 1973 when Dan took a coaching job at Morningside College as the men's basketball coach. They returned to Moberly, Missouri in 1986 where Dan coached at Moberly Junior College. In 1992, Dan accepted a job with the Sioux City Public Schools, coaching at West High School and later at Lawton Bronson Public Schools. Dan and Mary were thrilled to be back in Sioux City near family and friends again. They retired to Dakota Dunes. Mary passed away November 6, 2019. Shirley J. Ratke, 95, of Sioux City, passed away peacefully at home after a brief illness on December 8. Funeral services will be 11 a.m. Thursday, December 14th, at the First Presbyterian Church, Sioux City, with Reverend Mark Bedford officiating. Interment will be at Logan Park Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, December 13th at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Hospice of Siouxland. Shirley was born on February 23, 1928, to Ralph and Gladys Miller in Minneapolis. The majority of her life was spent in Sioux City. She married Willis Radke on February 6, 1947, and they lived in Kittery, Maine, where Willis was stationed at the Portsmouth Naval Base until his discharge from the Navy, after which they moved back to Iowa. They spent many wonderful years together until his passing on April 3, 1986. Shirley spent many years as a unit secretary at St. Luke's Hospital in Sioux City. She was a member of First Presbyterian Church. Shirley enjoyed sewing, baking, reading, working puzzles, and especially looked forward to playing cards with her many friends. Shirley traveled to Europe and throughout the United States, enjoying the history and the vistas she saw. She was always welcoming to family and friends and enjoyed preparing meals at any time, especially during the holidays. Family was the most important part of her life, and she would do anything for them. Shirley was a very giving and caring person, always willing to lend a helping hand. We were blessed to have her as our mother. Susan J. Kvols, and that's spelled K-V-O-L-S, 68, of Laurel, Nebraska, passed away on Thursday, December 7th, surrounded by her family and the Nebraska Nurse Honor Guard at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. The visitation was Sunday, December 10th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Laurel. The Mass of Christian Burial was Monday, December 11th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Laurel. The burial will be in the Laurel Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be given to Providence Medical Center in Wayne, Nebraska. Arrangements are under the direction of Munderloaf Smith Funeral Home in Wakefield. Susan was born November 11, 1955, to Felix and Mary Dorsey in Wayne, Nebraska. She was raised in the Catholic faith and was a lifelong devoted Catholic. She graduated from Wayne High School in 1974 and continued her education at Wayne State College and earned her registered nurse degree from St. Joseph's College of Nursing in Sioux City. Susan married Rodney Kvols on July 28, 1978 at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Wayne. To this union, the couple had three boys. Susan was a caring and giving person. She started her nursing career at Providence Medical Center in April 1979 and was an RN there for over 40 years. In 1998, she became a massage therapist and provided services at Providence Medical Center and opened her own place, the Muscle Shop, in Laurel. Susan was an active Catholic and was part of St. Mary's Altar Society. She had a passionate love for her children and grandchildren. She loved spending time with her family and attending as many of their activities as possible. Susan enjoyed riding horses and being around animals. Her caring and giving personality was shown by her actions. Susan was a hospice volunteer and proud of the fact that she recently became a member of the Nebraska Nurse Honor Guard. But her giving did not stop there. Susan was an organ and tissue donor. Her last giving act was to help some individuals in need of an organ transplant. And that concludes the obituaries for today. We do have time for one Dear Abby letter. And the letter is, "My wife is a very attractive 56. For years, she has wanted Botox treatments. Recently, it has become more serious because she feels like she looks like a grandmother. I and others continue to tell her how great she looks, especially when she dresses up. Also tell her Botox is a short-term fix and will require subsequent treatments. Additionally, with each treatment, she will risk potential problems with infection, allergic reaction, or medical mistakes. I remind her of the treatments that have gone wrong and that none of those women went to their doctors asking to look like a retired boxer. At this point, I'm concerned she may be depressed about aging and wants to do something to improve her looks, but I'm standing in her way. I love her just as she is, and I don't want her to do anything that ultimately could do damage. To me, the ultimate depression would be doing something harmful that cannot be corrected. Please advise. Signed, loves her the way she is." And Abby's response, "You clearly adore your wife and want what is best for her. That's why you should consider scheduling a consultation for both of you with a board-certified dermatologist who can explain the benefits and the risks of using Botox and may put some of your concerns to rest. When administered by a medical professional, there is little risk of a bad outcome. While you are correct that the effects last only a few months, Botox is popular among women in her age group and those even younger. The only drawback is that it isn't cheap. During your discussion, you may also want to ask about other products that are available and last longer, such as fillers. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, December 12th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.